Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Intellectual Property Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, October 15, 2014, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on today's oral arguments at the United States Supreme Court, brought to you by the Intellectual Property Practice Group. My name is Christian Corgan, and I'm the Director of Publications here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and also that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, again, this is one of our Courthouse Steps edition of our teleforms, and we're pleased to welcome our expert, Professor Kristen Osenga, who is a professor of law at the University of Richmond School of Law. More complete bios of Professor Osenga were provided to you or was provided to you in notice of the call, so I'll stop there and preserve more time for her presentation, followed by your questions. So I think with that, we'll just go ahead and turn it over to you, Professor Osenga, and the floor is yours.
Great. Thank you. As Christian mentioned, I am Kristen Osenga, professor of law at the University of Richmond School of Law. I have long been interested in claim construction in patent infringement cases, and I'm really excited to talk to you today about the Teva Pharmaceuticals versus Sandoz case that was argued before the Supreme Court this morning, and also my take on how it went. Please be aware, it's only my take. Other people might differ. The key issue in this case is what level of deference the United States Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit must give to a trial court's interpretation or construction of patent claim language. As you may know, patent claim construction has long posed questions for the courts. As recently as the mid-1990s, it was even unclear who was supposed to construe patent claims. Was this more of a legal question, like statutory interpretation, or more of a factual question, like many, but of course not all, aspects of contract interpretation? In 1996, the Supreme Court, in the Markman case, rather unhelpfully, observed that claim construction is essentially a mongrel practice, neither all fact nor all law, but held for various reasons that construing patent claims was, quote, exclusively within the province of the court, or that the judge was in the best position to interpret patent claims. With this backdrop, 2 years after Markman, the Federal Circuit held in the en banc CyberCorp case that the proper standard of review for district court claim constructions is de novo review, even extending to construction-related fact-based questions. Since this decision in 1998, the use of the de novo standard has been widely criticized. Numerous times it appeared that the Federal Circuit might revisit the issue and perhaps even change the standard, but the most stirring discussions of the de novo standard in patent claim construction were generally relegated to dissenting opinions, such as Judge Mayer's opinion in the Phillips versus AWH case. Just recently, the Federal Circuit, with a bench having a very different composition than it did in the 1990s, thanks to much recent turnover, took another head-on look at the standard of review for patent claim constructions in the lighting ballast control case. Perhaps this was a case that would end the criticism of the de novo standard. However, the Federal Circuit squandered the opportunity and instead affirmed the use of the de novo standard, finding no compelling reason to depart from its 15-year precedent. I guess with that last statement of mine, I may have tipped my hand regarding my view of the de novo standard. But more importantly, let's take a peek into what occurred this morning at oral argument to see if the justices may have tipped their hand. Of course, the framing of the question before the court may have already done just that. Whether a district court's factual finding in support of its construction of a patent claim term may be reviewed de novo, as per Federal Circuit precedent, or only for clear error, as per Federal Rules of Civil Procedure 52A. It would seem to me that the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure are going to trump Federal Circuit precedent every time, especially at the High Court. The question really is what constitutes a factual finding made during claim construction. But back to a discussion of the oral argument. The court today heard from Mr. J for the petitioner's Teva, Ms. Anders on behalf of the Solicitor General's Office, and Mr. Phillips for respondent Sandoz. Mr. J came out swinging with the point I just made. Rule 52 pretty plainly says that there is a deference for factual finding. It applies to all areas of law, and it applies even when the ultimate issue is a question of law based on underlying facts. The Federal Circuit's precedent, which lies on a strange fiction that there are no facts in claim construction, is just wrong. Consider that claim constructions are to reflect what words mean to a person having ordinary skill in the art, or as we like to call them, the foceta. Some claim constructions can be all law, but others are going to be based on what Mr. J called subsidiary facts. When pressed as to what those are and whether they would be hard for a court to separate, he answered that subsidiary facts are ingredients for determining meaning. For example, what does a foceta think a word means might be a subsidiary fact, but it's not controlling, because the judge can then decide, as a legal matter, that it means something else. Perhaps because there's contrary statements made during patent prosecution, or because the canons of construction point another way, or the doctrine that a patentee could be his own lexicographer and would use the words differently than a foceta might. As far as whether it would be hard for the Federal Circuit to separate findings of fact and questions of law, Mr. J responded that courts regularly deal with mixed questions, and the court could certainly handle it. Towards the end of Mr. J's time, Justice Alito cited to a Law Review article that said there was no practical significance between de novo and clear error review. And if there's no difference, then what is the point in complicating things and separating out fact and law? Mr. J responded that it does matter, because the Federal Circuit often doesn't recognize facts as facts in their opinion, so the study wouldn't pick up on this. And also, the Federal Circuit regularly skips the expert opinions of the foceta witnesses. This is a nice response, as the justices later pick up on it during Mr. Phillips' argument. Next up was Ms. Anders for the Solicitor General's office. Her statements did not do much to advance the ball, but did bring up an interesting colloquy regarding the consequences. First, Ms. Anders defined the factual findings as those that are based on evidence outside of the patent and prosecution history, ones that concern matters distinct from the patent. It is not a factual finding if the court is taking one part of the patent, for example, the specification, and using it to interpret another portion, for example, the claims. That, instead, is a legal inference, not a factual finding, and should not receive deference, according to Ms. Anders. Justice Kagan probed Ms. Anders to try to understand what her definition of factual findings would include by using the following hypothetical. If an expert says, in the field in which he's an expert, that the term molecular weight means something, X, and the district court accepts that testimony, is that a factual finding? After first deflecting the question by noting that that scenario was not the one in this case, Ms. Anders did admit that this indeed would be a factual finding, but she then followed it up by noting that significant legal analysis would follow that finding, and that is when the claim term is actually construed. This kind of tracks the argument that Mr. J was making, that a factual finding is simply an ingredient to be used with other things during the court's, the trial judge's claim construction. After that is when Ms. Anders' argument time got a little more interesting, as Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Breyer engaged in a discussion about the consequences that may follow if we have purely legal versus factual and legal decisions during claim construction. Specifically, Chief Justice Roberts pointed out that if it's a purely legal determination, couldn't two trial courts arrive at opposite conclusions, neither of which is clearly erroneous, and yet we would have a patent that would be binding on numerous people? Wouldn't that be a problem? Ms. Anders noted that this concern is largely overstated, and so it wouldn't really be a problem at all. But then Justice Breyer joined in and added a different hypothetical to the mix, stating, well, what about when there's a large bus accident and there's multiple lawsuits that occur in different venues? Aren't there also contradictory results possible in that instance? But in those instances, we don't care, do we? After engaging in a little more discussion about this bus accident versus a patent, they finally concluded the idea that a bus accident is a situational issue with the parties involved, a private problem, whereas a patent is supposed to put the world on notice. A patent is a public document, and so it's important that the claim construction be able to be relied upon by people. Ms. Anders instead responded that disuniformity in the patent world is okay because there are other values that supersede uniformity. This is a little troubling, perhaps, for people who work in the patent field and would like to see more uniformity and certainty. On the other hand, sometimes disuniformity brings about positive changes. Onwards now to Mr. Phillips. To be honest, I feel for Mr. Phillips because, in my mind, he had a tough road ahead of him, and the justices did not disappoint on that count. Sometimes when you listen to or read an oral argument, you see a party getting tough questions because you know the court is on their side, but they want to make sure that they get it right. In my opinion, this didn't feel like one of those times. Instead, it seemed that most of the judges really had difficulty accepting Sandoz's position. I'll give you a flavor of some of this and also one of their court's viewpoints on the Federal Circuit. Mr. Phillips started off pointing to the Markman decision, basically saying this case was answered years ago. Facts are subsumed into legal questions, and that's that. Justice Breyer then asked whether the trial judge has some benefit working with the facts, having it explained in front of him, seeing the witnesses, assessing their credibility, particularly in contrast to, per Justice Breyer's statement, three judges that won't even wade through the whole record normally. Mr. Phillips' response here and throughout is that patents are different. Patents are different, and patents are different, although when pressed later on in the argument, he doesn't really give an answer as to why. Justice Kagan asked Mr. Phillips if there were no subordinate factual issues in claim construction cases, or whether there were plenty of factual issues, but it wasn't worth the candle to figure out which ones were fact and which ones were law. And Mr. Phillips actually responded it wasn't worth the candle. Justice Breyer jumps back, noting the judges do this all the time. It's not really that hard to tell the difference. The justices then finally got to the meat of the matter. Where in Rule 52 does it say you can ignore a federal rule of civil procedure if it's not worth the candle or if it's too hard to tell factual findings from legal issues? Given that Rule 52 is pretty clear, where is the stopping point if we start deciding that the rule applies to some facts but not others? Why would we apply Rule 52 differently in patent cases than we would apply it in other civil cases? Well, patents are different, but why? This seems like a much bigger problem. The justices also tried to get at how Markman proceedings work. Justice Kennedy asked whether, when Markman proceedings include expert testimony, did this not involve findings of fact, to which the Federal Circuit must defer, and it seemed, although it's not entirely clear, it seemed that Mr. Phillips said no, that there's no deference, even when expert testimony is included in Markman proceedings. And Justice Scalia followed that up by asking, well, what's even the point of having an expert witness during Markman proceedings then? Just do it without them. Mr. Phillips finally answered that expert witness testimony can inform the trial judge, but that's it. So two last comments, one good and one bad, as I'm running out of time. The good. Justice Breyer stated, and I quote, "I am moved by the fact that the lawyers here are pretty much, who know patent law, are pretty much in favor," end quote, "of district courts doing the fact-finding." That warms my heart and makes me hopeful that he is moved by the fact that patent lawyers want this done right by the district courts. On the other hand, near the end of his argument, Mr. Phillips made the following remark. "You would have thought in the ordinary course, if I were writing a patent and I thought everything turned on a particular thing, here, average molecular weight, I might actually have bothered to define it. I can only imagine that some of the patent prosecutors in the gallery gasped. I guess it's probably a good thing that Mr. Phillips doesn't write patents in the ordinary course, as I at least was taught never to define something if I didn't have to." This is an important case with many consequences. There are cases pending at the Supreme Court already, awaiting the outcome of this case, as well as cases at the Federal Circuit. It almost feels like the patent world should be on hold until this all shakes out, which hopefully will be soon. Unlike some of the Supreme Court cases from the end of last term, where the questions were difficult, maybe this case will be answered as easily as it seems it might be able to be, and patent law can return to regular operation, albeit perhaps with a more deferential standard of review. And those are my remarks.
All right. Well, this is Christian Corgan again. We will now open up the line to your questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key. So again, if you'd like to ask a question or make a comment, press star and then the pound key. All right, looks like we had one question jump on.
Thank you so much. That was a great summary of what sounds like a fascinating argument. It's Marianne McGrail, an attorney in D.C. How would you address the issue? It sounds as though this wouldn't have come up in oral argument, but the issue of the disparate abilities of different district courts or experience with patent law and the kind of uneven results one is likely to get as a result of that.
That's a great question. So how would I address the disparate ability of different judges? And that may have actually come up slightly at oral argument with at least one of the judges, or justices, excuse me, remarking on the reversal rate that has been prevalent in patent claim construction. And certainly if we are concerned that district court judges might not all have the best abilities and competencies to do this, perhaps the reversal rate would be problematic again. But I think that district court judges are faced with difficult questions all the time, certainly when they get into medical malpractice issues, when they get into detailed scientific contract issues. They're wrestling with a lot of the same sort of difficult, technical, very intricate matters where expert witnesses become key to the judge's understanding of the underlying issues, and we aren't taking away those cases from the district court judges. We're allowing them to hear the expert testimony, see the stuff close up, try to assess the credibility of the expert witnesses, and make decisions based on that. In fact, we let juries do that too. And at least judges, this is their job, and they do this regularly day in and day out. But we also turn very difficult questions over to juries who, you know, this may be a one-time thing. Well, hopefully, is a one-time thing for most of them. So I understand the concern you raise, but I don't think it's anything different than what we already trust judges to do.
Thank you.
All right, well, our lines are open, so if you'd like to ask a question, press star and then the pound key. We do have about 40 people on the call, so we'll give a couple more seconds for people to think of any questions. Professor, is there anything else while we're waiting that you'd want to add that you didn't get to cover? Any other thoughts? It's okay if you don't.
No, I was just looking through my notes because indeed I did have some thoughts that I may not have been able to work in. The one thing I will say that I did leave out because it's an important issue, but it was really hard to see what direction things were going to go, and it really is the matter of the Markman cases. Are patents more like statutes, or are they more like deeds? Are they private documents, you know, or are they public documents? And so the question is that some judges will turn it on that question, whether they are like statutes or the Constitution or whether they're more like deeds. And so that is an issue that was addressed in Markman. In Markman, the answer was, well, kind of like both. But that may turn some of the justices' opinions in this case. So that is one thing I did not mention earlier.
All right. And one quick programming note for those of you on the call. Our next scheduled Teleform conference call is tomorrow at 12 p.m. Eastern, sponsored by the Civil Rights Practice Group. And that is on challenging racial preferences and government contracts with David Barton and Roger Clegg. Again, that's tomorrow at 12 p.m. Eastern Time at this same number. Well, for those of you on the call, we'll go ahead and do a last call for questions. If you have a question or a comment about the case, we'll do a last call. Press star and then the pound key. Oh, we did get one other question on the line.
Yes, hi, Claude Laporte calling. Do you think that this could be a unanimous decision, and do you think that there's any way for Justice Roberts to narrow the question in order to get a unanimous decision?
Okay, so the question is, do I think this could be a unanimous decision, and or do I think Chief Justice Roberts could narrow the question enough to get a unanimous decision? It could be. I think what I think the real problem is that there are some of the judges that did seem to be still hung up on the Markman idea of statutes versus deeds, and if that's something that they can't work through to get to the idea that really there are some underlying fact-based issues, then it's going to be really hard to square it with some of the other justices that seemed really against the idea of interpreting Rule 52 differently in patent law. So if you have a couple of the justices that really can't decide that these aren't like statutes, and you have the remainder of the justices really thinking that 52 applies no matter what because it's a federal rule of civil procedure and this is a civil case, I think it might be hard to come down with a unanimous decision. As far as could that be narrowed, I really don't think so. I think the question as it came up, as a question presented to the Supreme Court, is really straight up to the point. Do we go with the Federal Circuit de novo, or are we to go with 52 deference? And I don't see a way to narrow that at all.
Yeah, it seems pretty binary. Huh?
Yes, in my opinion, it's binary.
All right, any other questions on the line? Press star and then the pound key. All right, we did get one more question. Hi, you're on with the Federal Society.
Hi, it's David Emerson, Society member in Berkeley, California, and a patent attorney as well. The comments have been directed mostly to the district court level. Does the speaker have any thoughts on how the interplay of this decision would affect ITC reviews, Markman hearings there, and the standards for review?
Well, gosh, you know, I hadn't had any thoughts about that yet. I apologize. I apologize. I'm not even going to go out on a limb because I hadn't really put any thought into that, but that is an interesting question, particularly with as many cases that are going to the ITC. But I don't have an answer or even a guess.
Perhaps material or food for thought for a later teleform. Always giving us more topics to cover. All right. Any other questions? Star and then the pound key. Well, Professor, on behalf of the Federal Society, I want to thank you for joining us today and for going to the argument. Thank you to our audience for joining us. We always welcome your feedback by email to info@fedsoc.org. Please continue to join us for these special Courthouse Steps versions of our popular teleforums, as well as tomorrow's Civil Rights Law teleforum at noon Eastern on challenging racial preferences in government contracts. You can catch the podcast of this teleforum conference call, as well as the rest of our calls, on our website posted on our website. So until next time, we're adjourned. Thank you all very much. Appreciate you joining us.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.